So this assignment is one of those good news, bad news sort of deals. The good news is you're going to have to probably do less coding than you did in assignment number one. The bad news is it's not all going to be in Java. A significant portion of it will be in the JLEX language. And as we'll develop today, the whole notion is you can specify what you want using the notation that JLEX supports, and it will generate a scanner that implements what you want. In some ways, this is sort of the ideal that people have had for computing all along, that you essentially give your requirements, and the machine somehow figures out how it is that it wants, it's going to implement it. The difficulty in the larger world, as you might imagine, is even if you could do that, just automatically from a specification give a program, getting a correct specification is remarkably difficult. Just think, imagine in your own application, so perhaps some medical application, giving all the rules about what's legal and what's not. Is somebody allowed to do this or not? What if they misspell something? What if they don't include something? And a correct specification would have to handle, as ours will, not just correct entities, but also incorrect entities. In our case, which is specifying something as simple as tokens, just sequence of characters, people will make mistakes. And the question is, how do we handle those mistakes? At a minimum, we want to report them. In fact, some of you had an interesting experience with how to handle lexical errors, which you may not have even realized were very common, in that when you're doing test cases for assignment number one, if you created the programs on a Windows machine using a Windows editor, the rules in Windows are slightly different than they are under Unix or Mac in terms of how lines are ended. The Unix model, which is the one that I had because this was developed to run on Unix machines, including Macs, end the line with a new line. Turns out other systems use a different character called a carriage return, and Windows, inheriting the standard from DOS, uses a combination of a window of a carriage return and a new line. So if you were running a test and you saw this odd message, error, illegal character, ignored, and you looked at the line and column, it would always be at the very end of a line. And what it was doing is finding a carriage return, which was generated by your Windows editor, and throwing it away. Our good luck is that was just the right thing to do, because it wasn't really needed. But it's still the sort of thing which, when you program a scanner, you'll want to handle. What you'll probably want to do if you came across that in problem one is, when you do problem two, the thing I just passed around, extend very slightly my definition of an end of line to include an end of line character or a new line character, a new line character, a carriage return, or the combination. And again, I'm not even sure I remember which, does anybody remember which comes first, new line and carriage return, or carriage return and new line? Yeah, so it makes no sense. Just historically, if you wonder why those things even exist, it turns out way, way back when people were making the transitions from punched cards, they used an odd sort of terminal. You may have seen it in old movies, something that was essentially an old teletype. You perhaps see this where you have a continuous roll of paper and something click, 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 running characters. What would happen is, when you got to the end of a line, you would have to send a character new line, that is, go down one to a new line, one further down, and a carriage return, which means go all the way to the left end and start typing again. In fact, some of them were so fancy that they would type left to right, go down, and then type right to left. So zip, bip, 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 just to be a tad faster, because it would take a little bit of time for the physical print mechanism to go from the far right all the way back to the far left. If you ever played with an old mechanical typewriter, you saw a little bit of that when you hit something or other and the platen would slide all the way back. So historically, that's where it is. But even something as minor as accommodating different conventions, and again, it's not a very hard thing to do. Java certainly does it. But that's the sort of thing you have to program. So getting something that automatically builds a scanner is cool, but getting a correct specification is still a bit of work. So anyway, we'll get to that. Let me apologize if I caused any trouble last week by calling the class. If you remember the old Charlie Brown episodes, and it was a very popular cartoon once upon a time, there was a series of episodes where Charlie Brown would be ready to kick a football that was held by his sister Lucy. Now, does anybody remember what was always the theme of this? Charlie's going to kick the field goal, and Lucy would do what? She'd promise, I promise, I'm not going to do it again. And he'd go swinging, oops, just like that, go swinging his foot, and she'd pull the ball out of the way, and he'd go flying up and hit on his derriere. Well, it's kind of like me and weather forecasters. If you remember last week, the weather forecast says 7 days out, oh, there's this terrible storm coming. Oh, it's coming. It's going to be terrible. It's going to be horrible. Up to the night before, we've got 6 inches, and it's going to blow, and it's going to be rain and ice and sleet and gosh knows what else. And what happened? It turned out to be pretty much a fizzle situation. I guess the weather was still not terribly pleasant, but it was really not as bad as they promised. And they suckered me. So the weatherman pulled the football out from under me, and I apologize for that. So at any rate, what we'll be doing, what's going to happen is today's lecture is what would have been a week ago, and we had an open week for spring break. Now, for most of you being employees here or at some other company, spring break doesn't mean very much. So I'll insert the missing lecture in the spring break week, and we really will still stay up on schedule. Although I would have liked that this lecture was done a week ago to give you a little bit more advanced time. But before we get into Project 2, let's talk a little bit about Project 1, which is due tonight at midnight, actually 11:59, blah, blah, blah. And if you're going to take a day or two late time, don't feel too bad about it. There's a minor percentage. I think we take 3% per day. And that's more kind of a slap on the wrist to say, please don't fall behind, because if you steal time from Project 1, it'll come from Project 2 and so on. At the end of the semester, things have to be handed in so grading can be done. But one of the things people have been talking to me about is, well, hey, if I do have to end up turning things in late, can I do extra credit to counterbalance the penalty? And the answer, certainly you can. And it turns out there are two error situations that I mentioned in the assignment that I want to get to again. In fact, one of them is so easy that if you have the assignment working, not doing it is almost foolish, because it's like the proverbial stealing candy from a baby. And it turns out that one is the case of multiple declarations. It turned out that we had a little bit on Piazza today about a misunderstanding about whether you could have two simultaneous definitions of the same identifier with different types in the same scope. And the answer is you cannot for ordinary variables. In our language, it would be similar to Java. We will be able to do it for methods. But even in methods, the methods won't be quite identical, because in the case of an overloaded method, the name will be the same, but the number, type, or kind of the parameters will change. So it'll kind of look the same, but it'll be enough of a difference in the look so that you can easily figure out which one you mean. That means that if you have a situation where in the same scope, say just a single scope, you declare A to be an int and later you declare it to be a Boolean, or redeclare it to be a second int, which is even more foolish, that's an error. For the basic assignment, you don't have to worry about that. We will not test for it. You only have to work for perfect programs. Of course, that's a little foolish, because nothing's perfect, and as I was saying a bit ago, people make all sorts of silly mistakes. It's certainly possible that someone didn't understand the rules or mistyped or something else, and you have to give an error message. So I think number one on my list here is particularly easy, because it fits in the model you're already handling, namely, for each declaration, I do something. Now you have to ask, when I see a declaration, is it a valid declaration and not an illegal redeclaration? Turns out that's pretty easy to do. What you do is do a lookup in the current scope, only in the current scope, because all declarations apply to the current scope. It's legal to redefine something that's in an outer scope. All that means is the inner scope hides the outer scope. So you simply say, do a lookup in the inner scope. It means take the current symbol table, the innermost one, and do a lookup. Is the thing in there or not? It ought not to be. If it's not, then it's a valid declaration. If it is, it's an invalid redeclaration. And bingo, now you know it. So all you do is create an entry line similar to right down here that's very similar to an ordinary declaration. The declaration has a line number, it has a name, but it's not an int or a Boolean. Here I mark it as error, you could mark it as illegal redeclaration, etc. And of course it'll never have any uses because it's unreachable, it's illegal, nobody can ever look it up. And because nobody can ever look it up, you don't even bother putting it in the symbol table. So, hey, you're all done. You did the extra work of doing the lookup to see, is the guy already there? If it is, you make the special entry that's similar but not identical to a valid entry, the difference being it's not int, it's not bool, it's erroneous. And that's it. And that buys you extra credit, because now you're correctly handling a multiple declaration. A user seeing this will say, oh gosh, on line so-and-so, I declared A, but yes, I did have an earlier declaration. Something's amiss. And he or she will fix it, and that's fine. The other error is a tad more difficult, but certainly not real difficult, and that's the case of an undeclared identifier. That is, you use an identifier, but there's no declaration. In our language, that's not allowed. In some languages, it is. It's not clear that it's accepted. That's a wise idea, because one of the difficulties is if you allow implicit declarations, mistypes can be misinterpreted as new declarations rather than erroneous permutations of a valid declaration. But anyway, what you have to do there, what my recommendation is you've done a lookup, main scope, containing scope, and gosh, you don't find the identifier anywhere. So what I recommend is you have a separate table off on the side, a hash table or symbol table, that contains the names of identifiers that are undeclared and a list of uses. So if A is used in multiple places, you list out its use on line 10 and 12 and so on. And all you do is put the identifier in there. If it's already in there, add to the line numbers. That's very similar to the uses we have, but it's to the separate table, not to the symbol table for a valid declaration. At the end, you have to print them out. But it turns out symbol tables, hash tables, have a method that's already given you that will list all the keys that were used in that table. The keys, in this sense, will be all the identifiers you entered into the table. You can get those, and I think it spits it out as a list. Most of you took 367. You know lists can be sorted. You did, in the assignments, you did sorting on numbers, but sorting on strings works equally well. So let's say you sort them just so they're in nice, clean, alphabetical order. And then you just run through the list saying, here's the thing. You say, here's the name. You don't give a line number of declared because it's not declared. You don't give a type because there is no type declared. So you simply do the name, colon, and then a line of the one or more places where it was used. And presumably then the user would say, oh gosh, I meant to declare it. I wrote all this code down. I forgot to do it. And that turns out to be not uncommon. Maybe you do it. I sometimes do it, is I write all the code that uses an identifier first and then go back and add the declaration later. Sort of like the uses are more important than the declaration. Maybe you don't do that. Some people do. And if you put the uses in and you forgot the declaration, it shows you where all the uses are. You figure out where to put the declaration. And again, it's proved helpful. So the second one's a tad more work, but between them, certainly you'll get some extra credit. I'm thinking on the range of something like 10 or 15%. I'll have to talk to the TA and see what they're thinking. Enough to make it worth your bother, but obviously this is not as much work as the whole assignment. So something in that ballpark. So if you want to get some extra credit for against future assignments, which will be more difficult, I think, probably, if only because they're more advanced and use more a technology of compiling, it's a good idea. Or if you're going to be late because this problem turned out to be more difficult than you anticipated, you can compensate for late penalties by having extra credit. So any questions on that? Okay, so let me talk about what the plan is for today. The first two sessions, which are an hour each, I'll be continuing talking about scanning. The third final session, which is a half hour, will go to the assignment that I handed around, and I'll talk a little bit about that, what you're going to do, and so on. One of the cool things about the assignment we have now, and this will be the case for many of the future assignments, perhaps even all of them, is the way it'll work is you don't just do the assignment from scratch, sort of like you did here. Even in assignment one, it wasn't from scratch because you had something that paralleled what you were doing. But in the assignment I'm giving you for number two, I'm actually giving you a couple of definitions of tokens that you'll use in your final hand-in for assignment number two, and they're perfectly valid. So what you'll do is you'll take a partial solution and add to it. And one of the nice things about tokens is you can do them one by one. And again, you can have your choice. When I had assignments, there was always this question, did I do the easy ones first to get them out of the way and be sure I had some points? Or did I do the hardest one first? Because once I got it done, all the rest is downhill. You'll have a similar thing and it's your choice. You'll be able to define almost within minutes of understanding what I've lectured, new tokens. Well, of course, those will be the simplest tokens. There'll be more complex ones that'll take a more complex definition. And if you spend a lot of time on the assignment, that's where you'll spend the time. And then I'll spend a little time talking about error handling. How do we handle errors? And what do we do with them? And let me show you the importance of some of that is that you think error handling ought to be easy, and in many cases it is. In a lot of cases, it's simply saying, here's an illegal character, I'm not going to take it. But turns out there's some interesting alternatives, like if we have a quoted string, which we do. Oops, sorry about that. Oh, yeah, just, yeah. It used to be that on Monday Night Football, every football player, when he got on camera, would always say, hi, Mom, and that's sort of left. And now they do some kind of antics or something like that, or make some sort of gang symbol or whatever it happens to be. But in the old days, you used to say, hi, Mom. So a nice program would be to say, hi, Mom. But this is an illegal string in our language and in many others because it crosses a line boundary. And the reason it's illegal is just looking at this guy, even if you had a terminal, it's not easy to see exactly what's in the string. For example, how many blanks are between the hi and the line feed? Blanks are invisible. The line feed is invisible. You could get into an editor, and sometimes an editor will, you know, show you the column number. So you could figure it out, but it doesn't jump out at you. So your definition will say, if I feed that to you, or the TA does, this will probably get an error message, because there's a rule that says the line feed, the new line that is contained at the end of this line somewhere, may not appear in unescaped form in a string. What do I mean by unescaped form? What I mean is this would be perfectly legal, backslash new line, because it's visible. Now you can count the number of sizes. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 blanks, and then a new line. That's legal. So, but if the person just types a return and has the string appear to be on two separate lines without the new line, that's illegal. Okay, you'll handle that. In fact, the token will tell you. The token matcher will tell you it's illegal. But here's what will happen. It'll say this was illegal. It doesn't match any valid token. And what do? The easiest thing to do is throw away the illegal character. What's the illegal character? It's the quote. Uh-oh. That's not the smartest thing in the world to do in retrospect, because what will happen, would you imagine, with hi and the blanks after that happens? They'll be scanned not as part of the text, but as ordinary identifiers. So all of a sudden, you'll scan a hi, which may or may not parse, which may or may not type check, which may or may not generate valid code. You go to the new line and you'll see mom. That's another identifier. Then you'll see a shriek. And what is that in most programming languages? Excuse me? Not. So it's going to complain about having a unary operator at the right end instead of left end. Remember, not in most languages, including Java and our language, the not comes first and the expression comes next. So you say illegal Boolean operator. You say, Boolean operator? What the? And then you'll see another quote, and who knows what will happen. If, for example, you had another quoted string and you said, and dad, make sure we don't want dad to be excluded. What would happen is it would then pick up that, because a beginning quote and an ending quote both look the same in most programming languages. In some type systems, you have kind of curly one direction, curly the other direction, but most programming languages don't have that. So I'm not trying to scare you, but I want to show you that error handling is part of the game. And it's not as trivial, even as something as simple as matching ABC into an identifier or 1, 2, 3 into an integer literal. Some things are easy, some things are not quite so easy. So we'll have to get to that. So let's go back and get to lecture 3. Oh, let me go back a moment. Just to set the stage to where we were. This was 2 weeks ago now, so quite a bit of time. We were talking about something called regular expressions. Which I'll abbreviate regular expr. And all this is a mathematical-like notation that specifies not numbers, but strings. And as I said then, and I'll repeat now, it's kind of odd that words are so important to us that we don't have a notation for easily writing down patterns that represent various words. So we need that for our tokens, as you might imagine, because certain character patterns are allowed and others are disallowed. But even as something as simple as saying, I want to specify a pattern that says I begin with a P and I have 3 don't cares in the middle and I end with T. And I want to talk about those strings that match that pattern. Later on, we'll have to say, do we include lowercase or uppercase? And are they, what are these don't cares? Are they just letters? Are they any character at all? Whatever. But there's no notation. Notice I kind of drew this down, but this is just off the seat of my pants. In school, you never were taught that. Here's a notation to specify not numbers. So you learn about x squared minus 2x plus 13 equals 0. And that's also a pattern. And it's a pattern where certain numbers, certain values of x will satisfy this and others won't. And, of course, you learn, you know, there's a formula, you know, the quadratic formula for quadratic equations that will actually solve for that. So you learn how to solve for patterns for numbers. But you probably work with words at least as much as numbers, and you don't have something as simple as, let me talk about words that begin with P, end in T, and are 5 characters long. Again, why would you want that? Well, one thing, as I said, is you could use that in a cheater if you do crossword puzzles. You know, it's a situation, if you have a partner, you say, hey, you know, what's a 5-letter word that means blah, blah, that ends begins with a P and ends with a T? Or it could be the case you're writing a program here, and what's happening is you're doing handwriting recognition. And that's getting to be more and more popular. There's many situations you probably saw, in fact, you may have it, some of the tablets that have a stylus. You can write down something in kind of script, and it translates it into real honest-gosh text. And depending on you know, how fast you write it, so on, that's a viable alternative. But certainly the case some people have bad handwriting, as I understand it, and you may know better than I, usually these handwriting things work well if you use uppercase letters, Roman like ordinary letters, individual letters, but they're not so good if you have what's called cursive. That's where, you know, you run the characters together. So if you write hello, assuming you could read my handwriting, that may or may not be read by the program you have. So you could certainly end up in a situation where somebody's had bad handwriting. You say, okay, the guy wrote 5 characters, I think. The first one I'm pretty sure is a P. The last one I'm pretty sure is a T. The other 3, I have no idea. And then you go into some sort of database and say, what are the relevant words that have that formula? And we'll get into that. I mean, certainly one of them, you know, if it's around lunchtime, there's a certain beverage that comes out of Milwaukee that begins with a P and ends with T, and it is, I guess, right, this is a dry campus, so you never even heard about this. You know, there are certain adult beverages which thou may not participate in. And no, it's Pabst Blue Ribbon, which I don't know if you're a big Pabst fan or not. You probably never touched the stuff. But maybe all the guy was doing was putting in his order, say, here's what I want for lunch. Go and get me a burger and a Pabst or something. And maybe not here, but wherever they go. So that's one of the things. One of the things you'll learn about doctors is they preach one thing and do another. I had a doctor that said, oh, you know, you got to cut back on your caffeine and certainly shouldn't smoke. And they happened to have the door open to the doctor's lounge. And what did they have? One of the doctors there had a huge cup of what I think it was brewski. And not brewski, but high-test coffee. And they certainly had a cigarette sitting in the little tray smoking away. And it was a physician's lounge only. So some physician is telling his patients, don't smoke and don't drink caffeine beverages, and doing quite the opposite. So that's another issue. So anyway, what we're going to get into, going back to my presentation, is this notation about how do we talk about patterns of letters so we can, for example, define a scanner or other uses where we want to be able to recognize words that fit this form and exclude ones that don't. So we were talking about how do we build strings? What are the operations? We know how we build numbers. We add them, subtract them, multiply them, divide them, etc. We all know about that. But in terms of building strings, one of the most common ways of doing it is simply by listing out a sequence of characters. So if you're as bad a typer as I am, when you're typing out a word, how do you do it? First letter, second letter, third letter, and even though I have 10 fingers for typing-wise, I have 2 usually. Sometimes I'm smart enough I can use my thumb and the space bar or something. I'm sure many of you are better typers, but back when I was going to school, taking a typing class if you were male was not a wise thing to do because the other guys would notice it and, well, you know, they draw conclusions that you didn't want drawn and get yourself into trouble. So what we're going to do is we're going to build characters the old-fashioned way, typing them effectively one by one. And what we'll do is we'll take them from a given character set, which for symbolic reason, is called sigma. But all it is the alphabet. It's what are the valid symbols. We'll probably use ASCII, which is all the letters and numbers, upper and lower case, and you may have seen that. There are other character sets. Java is moving towards this Unicode, which is 2 bytes long and includes not just the Roman alphabet that we're most familiar with, but other alphabets too. It has Hebrew, has Arabic, has Cyrillic, has Greek. I don't know what the exact name is, but it has the alphabet used in India for, I think, Hindi. It has a linearization of Japanese language, and I think there's a linearization character-wise for Chinese and other languages, which I'm even less familiar with. So all that we're talking about here is not just the Roman alphabet. They could be used for other situations where patterns of symbols make sense. So we'll just simply go ahead and choose from there. The concatenated and the string gets bigger and bigger and bigger. To start things off, we have a special character, and let me switch back, that represents the empty string. And you're already familiar with this, but we have a different symbol for it. So we call it lambda. But all it is the empty string. And if you did string programming at all in Java, as you probably did, one of the more common strings you have is double quote followed by double quote, a string that contains 0 characters. And these two are identical. It just turns out lambda is the original mathematical term they used. And a string that has 0 characters in it, which, by the way, is legal in our language as well as Java, it's a good initializer. Just like 0 is a good way to initialize an integer, the empty string is a good way to initialize a string, because then you can start adding characters. Initially, I have 0 characters, then maybe I have 1, then 2, then 3, and so on. So we'll start out with lambda, and lambda is the empty string. So when I add a character or a string to it, the lambda effectively disappears. Just like adding 0 to a number, the 0 disappears and the number remains. So we go ahead and have lambda as the initial string or a way of appending nothing to a string. Now, it may seem like that's a pretty useless idea, but it turns out lambda is useful when you have a choice of accepting or rejecting an option. So we'll get to this in a bit, but in many cases you have, for example, a number like 1, 2, 3, and you can optionally put a leading sign on it, plus or minus. So the number is 1, 2, 3, and you have an option up front of putting a plus sign or the vertical bar is an or. That's not a 1, that's a vertical bar. Sorry about that. Or a minus. Or you may choose to have no explicit sign at all, which means, of course, that's implicitly a plus. And one way to do that is lambda. So you can say, I'm going to have 1, 2, 3 with an optional prefix. You can put a plus on it if you want. You can put a minus on it if you want. And you can put nothing at all on it, in which case the lambda appends to the 1, 2, 3, and all that's left is the 1, 2, 3. So it's useful in that way. You can also extend concatenation to sets of strings. And this will be the case where I showed you here a single number, but I could have a pattern for a sequence of any and all runs of digits, a single digit, 2 digits, 3 digits, as many as you want. And then I want to have a set of digits and optionally a prefix, which is drawn from a set of 3 options, the plus, the minus, or nothing at all. So applying this to sets makes some sense. And that would mean if I had a set of strings P and a set of strings Q, I could concatenate them together to form PQ, and anything in PQ has a string drawn from P followed by a string drawn from Q. So in the example I gave earlier, P is the prefixes and Q is the unsigned numbers. And PQ together is an optional sign followed by a number, a digit sequence. And that's how we could use it. So that's concatenation, because think of that as adding characters. Alternation is giving yourself a choice. And I've already shown you that with the vertical bar. So what happens is individual strings or sets of strings are separated by or, saying I could have this or that or that. And it turns out this is where the power of the notation comes into play, because let's go back just temporarily to what I had here. This is using vertical bars right here, and I'll make them extra vertical. I can write this down, But notice the cool thing is when the scanner has to get in around there, it has to figure out which of these choices I made. I don't tell it. I tell it, if a guy wants to throw a plus at you, that's fine. If they want to throw a minus at you, that's fine. And if they want to have no explicit sign at all, that's also fine. And then we're going to have the number 1, 2, 3. And you as a scanner have to figure out which of those three choices were made. Notice if I have more and more choices, that looks like it's dangerous. I could certainly imagine if I had 10 choices, I could do, let's try A, let's try choice B, let's try choice C. But as you might imagine, as the choices got more and more numerous, that would be slower and slower. Turns out that's not the case. We can actually write this down so that it embeds all the choices in its logic mechanism, and they're all included at the same time. It's not at all obvious how that might work, but it does in fact work, and we'll develop that today. So here's a case, and now we'll actually use something like that. We won't use quite this notation, because it turns out there's an even more succinct notation that's available in JLEX that we'll prefer. But this is saying a digit, that's one digit, can be any of the individual digits from 0 through 9. In this case, they're listed in numeric order, but that doesn't really matter. Think of them more as a set, where the vertical bars represent a comma, you know, and you have your set of 10 choices. We also allow to have things like parentheses, and I've shown you here, we'll use quotes, and we'll show you plus and star later. These can be operators. If you want them to be strings, they normally are escaped or quoted. So operator symbols can be used also, but we won't get into those quite yet. And so as I said, we will quote when there's a doubt about what we mean. And all I mean by that is that if I wanted to say, for example, I want to talk about the set of either left or right parens, I could write something like this down. If I didn't write the quotes around the left and right paren, they could easily be misunderstood as simply grouping together. I want to group together the vertical bar with something else. So by putting quotes around something, we can do it that way, or it turns out in JLEX, as well as explicit quoting, we can also use escapes, rather much like we do in ordinary strings in Java or C or other languages. An escape can be used, and that's sometimes preferential, simply because it's one fewer keystroke. Instead of putting double quotes on two ends, you can simply escape it out. And we'll talk more about that. So here's an example where I use parens in both ways. In this case, I use single quotes because they're characters. Remember, the thing is double quotes can be used for strings. Single quotes are used for individual characters. So it says here I have four special characters, a left paren, a right paren, a semicolon, or a comma. And I could use those as a definition of punctuation in my programming language if I decided I needed it. We can also extend alternation to sets of strings. And again, if I have P being one set of strings and Q being another, I can say P or Q, which says take a string from either P or Q. And I think I have an example of that. Yeah, here's a nice little example. If I defined a set lowercase, which is only lowercase letters, and I had a second set uppercase, remember, in some contexts, it makes a difference if something's uppercase or lowercase. If I said, I don't care, I want letters, uppercase, lowercase, mix and match them as you wish, I would say the lowercase or the uppercase, by exclusion, is all legal letters, all 52 of them. So I could define subsets and then group them together as appropriate, and I might wish to do that. Okay, the first two I showed you, you've almost certainly seen before and very familiar with them. This is something you haven't seen before that's really kind of interesting. It's sort of the cognate of multiplication. And it turns out it's called Kleene closure. That's after somebody actually was a former chairman of our computer sciences department and chairman of the School of Letters and Sciences at the university named Stephen Kleene. In his earlier days before he was a bureaucrat, he invented some cool mathematical notation. This is applied to a set. And it's represented by a postfix star operator. Why is it a postfix? Well, it's sort of used in the same way an exponent is. So let me just develop that. So if I write down a 1 and put a superscript on it, in mathematics, that normally means 1 multiplied by itself. But in terms of regular expressions, as we'll see, because multiplication is not numeric multiplication, it's rather replication, 1 cubed would mean 1, 1, 1. That is 3 copies. But suppose I didn't know how many copies I wanted. I could imagine a subscript that says any and all numbers you want, and actually Kleene closure, which is a star, represents 0 or 1 or 2 or 3 or as many choices of this as you want. So this would represent either no choices at all, which is lambda, or a single 1 or 2 ones or 3 ones or so on, any sequence of ones at all that you want. And you can see sort of the generalization from a fixed number to an arbitrary number. Turns out, as I warned you in a previous lecture, star has been taken from Kleene closure and it's now used in a variety of other programming contexts, including in Unix, a way as a file designator. So if you remember, and this was also used in DOS, if you learned that. So if I want to talk about all files that begin with A on a command line, I can say A star. It's not superscripted because, remember, in programming languages, in ordinary programming text, there's no superscript or subscript. They're just a linear sequence from left to right. So in that particular case, the star meant any and all character sequences. And if you remember, if I was in Unix, and I think DOS is the same way. In Unix, to list a file is ls for list. So maybe remember, what was it in DOS? It wasn't ls, it was something else. Dir? Excuse me? Dir. Yeah, okay, dir. No, I think that's right, yes. And all this would say, show me all the files that begin with A and have any suffix you want. So I knew the thing began with A and so on. And this star is really derived from the Kleene closure star. So there's sort of ideas that are good ideas reappear in various contexts. So we're going to use Kleene closure. And that's going to say if I have a set of strings P star. And again, we show mathematically a superscript in when we're actually doing tokens, it'll essentially not be superscripted. It'll be on the same line. So it'll essentially follow rather than be a superscript to the expression. This will say take 0 or more choices from P. And I'll show you an example of why that could be useful. I can also choose 0 choices, and that gives me lambda. Turns out there'll be a related operator that does not include 0 choices where you want at least 1. And it's up to you as a programmer to decide which of those two choices is the one you prefer. So here, for example, is a definition of all the lowercase characters as long as you want, including the 0 length string. So it can be 0 or 1 character or 2 characters, etc. Let me emphasize, if I repeatedly choose a character, it does not have to be the same choice. So LC star would include ABC or XYZ or AAA or BAB or any of the myriad possibilities. Mathematically, don't let this bother you. It's simply mathematicians love to show they know math. That if a string is in P star, then it's broken down into a sequence of substrings, each one of which is individually in P. So in my case of lowercase, if I said lowercase star, and I said I claim ABC is in that set, it's because A is in the lowercase, and B is a lowercase, and C is a lowercase, so choosing each of those and concatenating them together is a legal thing to do. And in this particular definition, we allow N equals 0 so that lambda is always included. That says I may not want any of them, but I may want one or more and put them in sequence. So with those three basic operations, we can start actually talking about regular expressions. That is, just like mathematics uses plus and minus and star and slash for division. Notice I'm so much into computing, I've forgotten the old style. It's not multiplication with a star. Sometimes multiplication is used with a dot, if you remember that. I always think of star. And it used to be, of course, division was a horizontal bar with something above and below. And to me, that's all long gone. It's now always a slash, 1/2, or 3/4. So after a while, programming warps your mind a little. If it hasn't happened to you yet, it will. probably. So just as we have formulas, you know, that have multiplication and division, even things like exponentiation, we're going to have regular expressions that develop ways to specify sets of strings, which are useful enough that they'll form the basis of our token definitions. In fact, if you peeked ahead at what I handed out, in one of the middle pages, I actually have all the tokens in our language specified using pretty much this notation. And we'll get back to that. Some are pretty trivial. Things like a comma is simply a comma symbol, or a left paren is simply a left paren symbol. Others are more complex, like numbers, which could have a sign in front of them, or identifiers, which can be mixtures of letters and digits, and so on and so forth. Or even more complex, as we'll get to, things like quoted strings. So one of the things we need for completeness, which you'll hardly ever use, is the empty set. It says, I can choose to define nothing at all. That's sort of like writing a mathematical formula that has no solution. It doesn't define anything, but a definition that of nothing is still a definition of sorts. So this is included, and it's like the empty set symbol if you ever studied mathematics with set theory. It's kind of meant to represent the empty set. That we won't use. Lambda, be careful. Lambda is not the empty set. It's the empty string. Why is it different? Because it is a string that has length zero. It's like zero is a number that has magnitude zero, but it still is a number. So lambda we will use from time to time, and it represents the string that contains no characters at all. Usually that's used in combination with an option. We're going to have a basic definition and optionally add to it. So for example, an identifier is letters, optionally followed by digits. And I could choose not to have the digits in there. And one way to do that is choose lambda as my suffix. Excuse me? Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. You got to, oh, me. No, it's the empty string. But normally what we'll do is when we write, one way to write a set is to write down the series of strings that are included in the set. So would it be more precise? If we did, except unfortunately we use curly braces for other purposes. So what we do is, it's sort of like mathematics. When I had my formula back there, remember the x squared, blah, 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 blah. It could very well be that particular equation has more than one root. It quite possibly has a minus root and a plus root. You know how it is that sometimes that quadratic or cubic equations have multiple roots. Writing this thing down there implicitly is saying, here's the set of numbers that are solutions to this equation. So implicitly, that's also a set. But we don't write curly braces around it. It says anything that fits that formula is included. Anything that doesn't fit that formula is excluded. So yes, in the strictest sense, if I write down lambda, that's a singleton set that contains one string, the string of length zero. But I don't usually bother to put braces around it simply because it detracts from the notation. So now we get down to some real power, and I'll get to some real examples before too long. So if A and B are regular expressions, A or B, we'll certainly use that. A followed by B, this is catenation. There's no explicit catenation operator. It's rather like mathematics. Remember in mathematics, one way to multiply numbers is simply juxtapose them. So if I write down 10x, that really means 10 times x. I can write down the star symbol if I want or the dot or whatever, but putting two things together, or if I write xy and I have singleton variables, that means x times y. Well, similarly, just as in mathematics, juxtaposition means multiplication. In our particular situation, it'll mean catenation. But if you think about it in a way, that's sort of a generalization of multiplication from numbers to strings. So remember, if you say 2 times 3, it says multiply 3 with itself twice. If I write some string juxtaposed with another set of string, it means jam them together, juxtapose them together. So here's an example where an easy way to write down a regular expression is to simply write down the set of options. And the way you do that is use the vertical bar. And in this case, if I have a finite set, and in many cases you do have a finite set, Here's a case where, I guess I was teaching this to a class doing C, goes how far back it goes, that these are all the reserved words in ANSI C, auto, brake, case, etc. These are things, remember, reserved word is what looks like an identifier, but is pulled out of the set of valid identifiers and has a special purpose. Some of these in auto, I'm not sure if you remember what that is. Brake, we have in our language. Case, we don't, but that's kind of a generalization of an if, and a variety of others. And we just happen to write them in alphabetic order because I stole them from a manual, which put them in alphabetic order. And the dot, 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 by the way, is not valid notation. That's just me using ellipses to show there's many more that I'm not going to bother to list out. So if you see examples where I use dot, 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 that's laziness. You're not allowed to use that in a real full definition because, of course, the scanner generator can't really know what you mean by dot, dot, dot. If it's never heard of ANSI C, how could it know what the reserved words are? So in this case, it begins that way, and I don't want to bother to show you the rest. So be forewarned about that. So besides the three basic ones we saw, alternation, catenation, and clean enclosure, I'm going to add a couple of others that are useful. It's just like in mathematics, besides the ones we have, there's other things that are useful, things like a square root operator or a logarithm operator or so on. They're a little more complex, but they are useful in their own right. So star means zero or more repetitions, plus means one or more repetitions, and plus turns out to be very useful in cases where I want to have the empty string excluded. So if, for example, I wanted to define the identifiers very simply as simply a sequence of letters, forget about digits, although digits turns out to be pretty easy, I could write down lowercase or uppercase plus. Plus means I can take one or two or three or as many as I want, and that's a formula. And in fact, I could use that for a very simple identifier definition. An identifier is uppercase or lowercase letters in any combination, one or more of them. Turns out I can be a little more complex, though, because there's a rule that says identifiers normally are allowed also to have digits in them. But what's the rule about where digits appear in an identifier? Now, again, you don't know in our language until you take a peek, but what is it in most languages? You are allowed to have numbers, so I could certainly say test one. And I can even have digits in the middle, like P to C. In fact, that's actually the name of a program that would translate from Pascal to C in the old days, Pascal being an old language. And you probably saw programs that use the digit two as an alternative to TO in the English sense of the word. But where's the one spot where you're not allowed to have digits in an identifier? At the very beginning. And the reason for that is it makes it a little confusing as to whether this is meant to be a standalone digit or not. So I'm not allowed to say 1A as an identifier. I could say A1. A1 is oftentimes used as an abbreviation for top quality. But 1A would not be allowed. How does the poor old scanner know that? Well, the way it knows it is because we tell it. And here's how I could tell it to do that. I could say, you've got to begin with a letter. And a single letter is fine. So you're going to have an identifier like A or B or I or J. But I can also have a suffix that contains lowercase letters or uppercase letters. Or remember, several slides back, I had D for digits, any one of the 10 single digits. Now, that's not quite complete. I have to add something to that. Can anybody guess what I need to add? This by itself would specify something that was exactly two characters long. The first one began with a letter, and the second one was a second letter or a digit. That's legal, but it's not quite as general as I want. So how would I change that to, say, fit the definition that we normally expect, namely, begins with a letter and can have additional letters or digits following it? I put a star. And here's the case where you had to choose between plus and star. Here's where star is good because if I choose not to have a suffix, I still have a single letter. So I'm not going to have an identifier that's invisible. We probably don't want an identifier that's equal to lambda because you could never see it. And therefore, that wouldn't be terribly useful. But in this case, I have a prefix that says all identifiers begin with a letter. And they have letters or characters or digits following them as much as you want. So now I could have various combinations. I think a little later I have an example that will also use underscores. And sometimes there are rules about if you have underscores, how they may be used. The trouble with underscores being they kind of look like minuses and various things. But notice this is getting to be a fairly useful definitional mechanism. It's not hard to write down. And the cool part is I can essentially write that down. When you write down your definition for identifiers, let me pull out my example just to point you to it, just to get a little ahead of myself. Yeah. If you look at the top of page 2, the second bullet, it's almost exactly what I have down here. It says it begins with a letter. It then has a suffix of letters or digits, start. And the only thing I have, this little notation, minus reserved. That's, by the way, a cheat because many systems, including JLEX, do not support minus. So this is more meant in the mathematical sense of minus, of removing something from a set. And what's reserved, what's minus is reserved words, which says if I can form something like, what is our reserved word, bool, or break, or if, or int, or something, those are excluded. So my definition has to be saying we do have something called reserved words, and reserved word says you may not have an identifier that matches one of these fairly small set of special symbols that are meant to form the structure of our programming language. But other than that, notice this definition is exactly what we have. And in a language like Java or C, it's not all that very much different. So the cool part about this is I say, okay, here's what I want. Forget about reserved words. There's a cool way of handling those too, by the way. Is simply write down this pattern and say, Mr. Scanner Generator, it's your job to match things that fit this pattern. If they match it, I want you to recognize it. If they don't match it, don't bother me. You figure out how to implement it. Here's what I want. So again, this is the cool part of it, is this is not saying how to scan. It doesn't say look at a character and check the next and do this or do that or something. It says, here's a pattern. If it matches, bingo, I want to know about it. If it doesn't match, either match something else or give me an error message saying nothing at all matches. So if, for example, I had something as simple as this and I wrote down A1, it would be the scanner's responsibility. Again, assuming that it doesn't have numbers included, just this guy. It would say, is test 1 valid? It would figure out, yeah, it matches the pattern. Is P to C valid? Yeah, it figures out it matches the pattern. Is 1A valid? No, it doesn't match the pattern. So it would say good, good, bad. But it says that automatically without you programming it. You just implicitly said what you want. And by implication, if it's not what you want, it's what you don't want. And it automatically handles it. So that's the beauty of the approach when we get it all working. So we have this plus, which I just showed you up here. I showed you previously, and here's another example where I wanted to write down binary strings. Now, some programming languages allow you to write down numbers not just in decimal format, like we're used to, but you can write it down in binary format, zero or ones, or octal format. That means you can use 0 through 7, but nothing above it, or even hexadecimal, which means you can use 0 to F, which I believe F is 15, and that's base 16. And you may or may not have seen those, but they're all valid notations. And languages like C actually allow you to write down numbers in those forms by doing a special notation. So one way to do binary numbers is to write down 0 or 1 plus. But then how do you know if something is meant to be binary or decimal? In many cases, what they do is they put a suffix around it. In many cases for binary, you put a B after it. So you say anything that's a sequence of 0 or 1s and ends with a B is meant to be a binary number. And in some cases, you know, binary numbers are handy because they have certain patterns, and depending on what you're programming, seeing it in binary is more useful than seeing it in decimal or octal or some other decimal format or some other numeric format. Oh, here's something that's going to be extremely useful and is a nice abbreviation, and it is the not operator. Now, notice this is applied to characters. So rather than saying, here are the characters I want, you can say, here are the characters I don't want, and that's by exclusion. So it's an abbreviation because all this is a way of saying, here are all the characters I want. I could have simply gone into the character set, which is always finite, and pulled out all the characters that I don't want out of them, and the remainder would be there. So you can say, for example, I want every character except this or that or a sequence of things. So you can say, I want all the characters that are not digits. So I could do that by simply saying not 0 or 1 or... And again, these ellipses here are just me being lazy. So I could simply say, I don't want the digits. I want everything that's not a digit. Why is that? Well, we'll have to see the context of it. But later on when we show an example of comments, the body of a single line comment starts with two slashes and includes anything that's not an end of line character. So by implication, it extends up to but not including the end of line. And it turns out if you look at our definition of a single line comment, it is exactly that using the not operator. So not turns out to be fairly handy. And be careful because not does not contain lambda. Not is always a set of individual characters, each of which is one character long. So lambda is not a character because it's a zero length. Characters are always one, length one. So be careful. Not does not include lambda. What it is essentially the complement. It says, whatever I show you is a single character or sequence of characters. I don't want those guys. I want everyone else but. And in some cases, that's useful. One of the places where that might be useful is we're going to be talking about strings as possibly containing unprintables. Now, we'll have to define exactly what an unprintable is, but normally strings, that is double quote things, do not allow you to include unprintables in their native form. And it turns out we talked about a couple of those, like new line and carriage return. Also things like tab character. Turns out also there's a bell character. I don't know if you ever heard about that, but in the old days when you had a teletype, how did teletype wake up the operator who in theory is watching the teletype, but in practice is probably napping? And this is, you know, things you're getting a message coming in from the Pentagon. Danger, 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 missiles attacking. And how would you wake somebody up? Well, there was a character called the bell character, and it's still included in the ASCII set, and it's actually implemented on many systems. So if, for example, you're writing a program and you want it to wake you up when it's done because you're napping or talking on the phone or texting away or something, you can print out the bell character. And the way you, quote, print a bell character is it beeps at you. And different machines have different tones and all that. But our rules are you may not have an unprintable in a character set. Well, how do you talk about an unprintable? Well, one way to do it is use their numeric codes, but sometimes you want to say, I want everything that's printable. What's printable? Everything that's not unprintable. So one way to do that is to list out the sequence of characters that are unprintable. Turns out in ASCII, that's a pretty easy thing to specify, and simply say, I don't want any of these guys. So anything else but that is a possibility in my quoted character or quoted strings, but unprintables are not allowed. We say, well, wait a minute, this is pretty cool. What if I want an end of line or a tab or others? Well, remember the deal that you have in conventional languages is you can specify them in printable form. So in a quoted string, I can say backslash tab or backslash new line. We don't have the carriage return in our language, but it is in Java. That's backslash R. And I think they also include the bell character. The way I always remember the bell character is it's not backslash B, it ought to be, but it's backslash G, and I always remember G for gong. If you remember way long ago, there was a gong show, and the gong show, if it's on reruns, you ought to watch it because it would be the, it's like the, what's the show, you know, where somebody gets to be a star? I'm escaping me. You know, everybody wants to be the great star. Excuse me? American Idol, maybe? Yeah, American Idol. And the only American Idols I ever watched were the first couple of episodes where they had these unbelievably bad people, and they didn't know it. So you'd be a country singer, you thought, you know, saying, oh, I'm a country singer, and they're so bad that all the judges are laughing or virtually laughing. But after all the good bad guys are gone and they're pretty good, then I don't watch it anymore. So if you wanted to do that, what you'd have is, I think, backslash G for gong, and you could check out and see and has that in there. So if you're ever writing a program in C, and I think Java may have it in there too, that if you put a backslash G in there, it'll print out the bell character, the gong character, by beeping at you. And if you want to have long beep, just do many of those. Beep, 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 beep. And you can even do Morse code. Two beeps, you know, followed by a blank, followed by three beeps means, you know, your supervisor's on the way and you better start to look busy or something. So anyway, what we then do is exclude the actual characters. Now, you're starting to get confused and say, but aren't those the actual characters? And here's the funny thing. We're sort of on the cusp between when escape characters mean something and when they don't. In fact, we're the people that, in programming languages, make an escape character mean something. Oops. There's my gong character. See? So let me just finish that, just because of this thing. Backslash T, if you just type it in an ordinary editor, is not a tab character, is it? Just go in an ordinary text editor where you're writing up documentation. Backslash T are just two characters. But inside of a quoted string, somebody like you processing the string says, hey, this person is not allowed to write a tab character, which is one invisible character in a string, because it's invisible and would not be easily read. What you are allowed to do is write down a backslash T, which says, in this place, when the character is materialized into an implementation, put a tab character in there. That gives you the advantage of being able to see the tab character in the source program and use it in its tab-like form when the program runs. So how did the magic appear? Because like most magic, you had to implement it. So all cool things happen because people worked hard to make the cool things happen. So that was a good break there. So what we'll do is we'll take about 10 minutes, start up again, we'll have another hour talking about scanning, and then the final half hour will be on the project, and we'll actually go in there and talk a little bit about some of the definitions and so forth. So we see you in about 10 minutes. I guess it's officially 6:30, so we see you about 6:40.